Get ready for Keeping It Real with Randy McMullen, brought to you by Amstar Mortgage Network and MLS number 148016. Stay tuned as Randy McMullen interviews realtors, credit specialists, closing attorneys, appraisers, insurance agents, home stagers, and others to prepare you for getting a mortgage and buying or selling a home. For more information, visit AmstarLoans.com. And now, your host for Keeping It Real, Randy McMullen.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. This is Randy McMullen with Keeping It Real. And today we want to talk about something, and I guess I would say what most people do not know about the mortgage industry. I think a lot of people have a general idea of what happens in the industry, but there's, boy, a ton of things that people just either don't know, don't understand, a lot of misconceptions. So today I kind of feel like the guy on television. You may have seen the show where the magician's telling all the magicians top secrets and showing you how things are done. And that's kind of what we want to do today with the mortgage world, is kind of peel things back and let you know how things work a little bit better. And that may help you when you get ready to get a mortgage to make a better decision and to get the right person to help you out. The first thing I want to talk about is how rates work. And that may seem like a really, really simple thing, because you call up your mortgage person and they say, okay, today's rate is whatever it is, 4.5%, 4.25%, 4%, whatever the rate is at that point in time. And you think, okay, that's my rate. But the reality is it doesn't work quite as simply as that. When rates come out every day, you're going to find that, let's say that the average rate that people are quoting is maybe 4.5%. The rate sheet probably has rates from 3.5% all the way up to maybe 5 or 5.25%. And you're getting one of those rates quoted to you. So the question is then, which rate is the best rate for you? And
wouldn't it make sense to most people that the lowest one is the best one?
You would think a lot of people go, hey, I want the lowest rate. But the reality is almost never is the lowest rate the best rate. And here's why. And this gets into a little bit of math, and I'll be glad to share that math with you. If you want to kind of look at your own situation, feel free to give me a call. You can look me up on www.amstarloans.com. And if you have any questions, just shoot me an email, give me a call, and we'll answer them for you. But in regards with rates, let's say you could get a rate of 4%, and you're told that there are no points on that rate. And you think, okay, that's great. I've got good closing costs and that type of thing. Now, what if I told you could get a rate of 4%? Well, of course, you go, oh, wow, lower rate. I want that. But how much does it cost to get that lower rate? And if you're doing let's just say a $200,000 loan, for example, and I tell you, you can get 4%, but it's going to cost you $10,000. Do you really want to spend $10,000 to save $50 a month? Probably not. So there's a point where some rates it makes sense to buy the rate down, and sometimes it doesn't make sense to buy that rate down. And actually it varies on a day-to-day basis, because rates are never the same. It's a very fluid market. So as rates are changing, you might find that today is 4.5, but the cost to get 4.375, again, that might be 1% of the loan. So on a $200,000 loan, it might cost $2,000 to save 1/8%. Obviously, you don't want to do that. But what if you could get 1/8 point and it only cost you 3/8 point to get that? That's where buying the rate down makes sense. So your originator should be doing the math on those rate options, and they should be providing you those rate options in writing.
What's the formula, Randy? In other words, what length of time within which does it make sense to buy it down?
That is an excellent question. And the answer to that is it depends. If you were going to tell me that, hey, I'm going to be moving in 3 years, we're buying this house and I know I'm going to get relocated, or, you know, I've got 3 or 4 years left and I'm just buying this house for my kids to go to high school, and then when they go to college, we're going to downsize. That's one scenario. Another scenario is, hey, we're just moving in this house. My kids are going to first grade. We want to stay in this house for at least 12 years. That's a different thing. So if the cost to buy the rate down and to save $20 a month cost you, let's just say, $1,000 to buy it down, half a point, then you'd say, okay, $1,000 divided by 20, it takes 50 months. So it's going to take you 4 years to break even. If you're going to be in that house for 10, 11 years, heck, why not buy the rate down? You got your money back in 4 years, and the next 6 years, 7 years, you're saving even more money.
What's that saying? You know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Because people, you know, when my wife and I moved here, we wanted to stay. All we cared about was the elementary schools because our daughters were just starting elementary school.
Right.
That was 28 years ago. We're still in the
you're
same house.
You're still there. Yeah. You know, that's the other thing. We ask people, I tell them, this is my trick question, how long do you plan on staying in the home? And nobody goes exactly a specific time. But people do have an idea if it's going to be a shorter term or longer term. So we do the math on that. Now, here's the part that I think people really just don't get. And that is, I might look at your situation and say, hey, here's your rate of 4.5 with no points. But why not take a rate of 4.625, and it's actually giving me a credit of $1,000 that we can give you towards your closing costs to lower your closing costs. So now you're going to pay $20 more a month because you got a higher rate.
Save $1,000 right now.
But you're saving $1,000 today.
That's very tempting.
And if you're going to be in the house for 3 years, then all of a sudden you actually come out ahead saving $1,000 up front.
Am I greedy if I favor saving the money up front?
No.
One of the scenarios you've mentioned today so far, I've been in favor of saving the money up front.
It's, you know, a lot of people do that.
You know, green money, you know, cash, green mm-hmm. money.
Well, you know, here's the thing.
I'd rather amortize over the life of the loan.
And you have to look at your, you know, we talk about return on investment with people. If you can take that $1,000, put it in the bank and make even 3 or 4% somewhere in a mutual fund, you know, nothing crazy, that money's going to last you a lot longer and you're going to come out even further ahead. So, you know, you've heard people talk about, oh, no closing cost loans. Well, they're not no closing cost loans. Your attorney gets paid, the credit report's got to get done, the appraiser's got to get paid. All the fees are the same. What you're really doing is you're taking a higher interest rate. And here's the thing. Sometimes it makes sense to do that.
They don't say that when they advertise.
Of course not. They just tell you it's no closing cost. But they don't tell you the other part of it, which is it's higher rates. You really have to do the math. There was a regulation that was put into place a few years ago, and it requires a lender to provide you with – you're required – to provide you with more than one option. They're supposed to describe multiple options to you, the lowest cost mortgage, the lowest closing cost mortgage, the lowest rate mortgage, and then you're allowed to make a decision based on that. And if you're not getting that information, or you didn't get it the last time, you need to look at the next person you're doing the mortgage with and say, hey, I need to get some different options so I know that I'm making the best decision. Now, I want you to also understand that's not going to impact the person that's doing the loan, the loan originator, is not making more money because you're getting a higher rate. That's all been fixed by the government, too. And those regulations say that the originator and the company make the same amount of money regardless. But it's just some people either don't understand the math or they're too lazy to do the math, and they just don't want to get into those discussions. But you really want to make sure that you're getting the best combination of interest rates and closing costs. So that's kind of the first thing. Is you want to make sure you understand how your interest rates work. And along the lines of interest rates, you then have a term that everybody's heard of. It's called APR. It stands for annual percentage rate. And a lot of people will call us up and say, I want the lowest APR. What's your APR? And they don't even know what APR is. They just know that they've been told, hey, I need to ask for the lowest APR.
What's that saying? Randy, a little bit of knowledge, you know.
It's a dangerous thing, and it's you know, it's been ingrained for so long. But again, the best loan for somebody is the best combination of closing cost and interest rate and payments over the course of the term of the loan. And I wish I could tell you that everybody calculated APR the same way, but they don't. I have 10 or 12 different companies, I've asked them for their formulas, and lo and behold, they have different ways of calculating APR. And there are some little tricks that people in the industry can play to make the APR seem lower, but it doesn't matter. All you really need to look at is, what's my interest rate, and what are the closing costs? Those two things we're going to tell you, which at the same rate, you can just look at the lowest closing cost. It doesn't matter who's got the lowest APR.
Why do they have that term then?
The reason it was invented was the idea was to have everybody calculate APR the exact same way. And then some legal people got involved with the process and told the lenders that they represented that here's how you can do it. And then there were some just ways that you could change some of the numbers. They would all add up to the same, but you could move one number to a different column. And all of a sudden, whereas it normally counts in your APR over here, now that I've moved it to this column, it doesn't count in the APR anymore.
So it sounds to me like APR has done more harm than good, that concept. It's confused people.
Well, nobody understands how it's calculated. And when I say nobody, I mean most of the people in the mortgage industry included. It includes, for example, most people don't know the attorney fee is included in the APR. So that's one thing that can impact it. The processing fee, the underwriting fee. Now, those fees aren't really interest, but for the purposes of calculation of the APR, it is how they're calculated. So it's a big misconception, and you know, you want to pay attention to it, but it's not the most important thing because you, other things like mortgage insurance factor in. So you want to take a look at it. We're getting ready to come up on a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about where do interest rates actually come from? How do they come from the government? Does the government set them? So I want to talk to you about where they come from, and you know what's going on and how they're set.
And then you'll tell me where babies come from.
And then we're going to tell you where the babies come from the rates. Absolutely.
And now, back to Keeping It Real with Randy McMullen of Amstar Mortgage Network. Visit AmstarLoans.com.
We are back, and thanks for joining us. This is Randy McMullen. I'm joined with Jeff Davis, Vice President and General Manager of JW Broadcasting. And we are here to answer the question on this segment, where do interest rates come from? And does the government really have an impact on what rates are? You'll hear people sometimes say, mortgage rates come from 10-year Treasury notes. And the reality is they come from 30-year mortgage-backed securities or mortgage bonds. These bonds are auctioned daily just like stocks are sold daily, and they go up and down daily. So are they set by the government? Is it set by the Fed funds rate or the prime rate? No, they're not. But can the government impact interest rates? And the answer to that is not only can they impact interest rates, they do impact interest rates, but not the way you might think that they do. You probably have heard of QE1, QE2, QE3, and one you may not have heard of, a really slick program that they put into place a couple of years ago was called Operation Twist. All of these things, the government said, we're going to start putting all this money and we're going to go into the market, this auction that happens every day, and we're going to buy bonds. And we're just going to buy and buy, and we're going to soak up all the supply. And lately, for the last year, they've been buying up to $40 billion of bonds per month. And so by buying all that, they're driving those rates down. Now, we're also printing an awful, awful lot of money. Normally, the money supply is determined by the growth rate or the population rate. In this case, the government was mandated to kind of control things with as they could and keep the economy rolling. And they do want some inflation. They want 2 or 3%. But in this case, they decided there were some other objectives in keeping the economy stable. And they started printing all this money and pumping it into the economy and buying these mortgage-backed bonds. And that's what's held rates kept rates low. Operation Twist was really slick. As five-year and the short-term notes matured, they took the money out. And instead of buying new 5-year treasuries, they bought 30-year mortgage-backed bonds.
So why have rates slowly creeped up then?
Well, they crept up because last year, towards the end of the summer, Ben Bernanke came back and said, we're going to start tapering our $40 billion worth of bonds. And they're buying 85. Some of that was 10-year treasury notes, and some of that was mortgage bonds. So they've let the short-term rates float up while they've driven the long-term rates down. So now that they've made the announcement that they're going to back out of the market kind of overreacted, and rates jumped about 1% in about 45 days. But here's the really interesting thing, and it's not a direct one-to-one correlation. So it isn't that now the Feds are going to stop buying bonds, and so rates are going to go back up. Because here's another interesting dynamic on that. the stock market plays an equal important role in what happens to rates. So when the Fed says we're going to stop buying bonds, then those rates are going to start creeping up. What impact do higher rates have on the economy? It causes people not to spend as much. So when people don't spend as much, retail sales drop. When retail sales drop, stocks drop.
Ripple effect.
It's a ripple effect. So what happens is sometimes the Fed will make this announcement. Instead of seeing rates go up, you might see the opposite because people in the stock market kind of freak out. Stocks drop. They have a down day of 200 or 300, and all that money flows into bonds. So now there's more pressure to buy bonds, and it actually either keeps rates the same or can actually, in some cases, lower rates in the short term. Longer term, and again, there's two different ways to look at it, it is eventually going to raise the rates, but shorter term, it can have a nice impact. Knowing these things can really help you when you're trying to make a decision about locking in.
Rates are still very low, though, in my opinion. I go back a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, what, 4%? That's high? What, are you kidding?
I remember I had a conversation, it's been a while, a year ago, and there was a young first-time home buyer in her 20s, and, you know, rates had gotten down to 3.5%, and they went up to 3.75, and I remember the conversation about, rates have gone up so much, I don't know, I think I may wait for rates to float back down. I'm trying to say, they're 3.75. This is just crazy, crazy good. But, you know, for them, since they had started looking, all they had seen was 3.5, so in perspective, it looked like a higher rate, but in reality, 3.75 was an awesome rate. Now, there's some other things that impact where rates come from or how rates are impacted with these charts. For example, every week there are lots of reports that come out. There are retail reports that come out to talk about, are retail sales up or down? If retail sales are up, that means the economy's strong, stock market's going to go up, and when people put money into stocks, tend to pull money out of bonds, interest rates go up along with that. Inflation. Interest rates and inflation are arch enemies. If the inflation rate is 3% and you've got an interest rate of 4%, it's a difference of 1%. Banks don't like that. So as inflation comes into the market, then you're going to see interest rate goes up. And there's where a lot of people have been very concerned, is because we've pumped in $80 billion a month, $1 trillion a year for the last couple of years. Where is all that money going to come from, and how are we going to pay for it? And the reason why we don't have inflation now, it's really interesting. One of the things that they changed, the regulation they changed here not too long ago, was they started paying banks interest on the money that they were forced to keep in reserves. So banks have a ton of money in reserves. So all this money that the Fed's printing, why hasn't it caused inflation? And the reason is because the more money you put into the circulation, the more inflation you should have. But what's happened is that since the Feds have said, okay, banks, you put this money in reserves, we're going to pay you interest on that money in reserves. So now banks have no incentive to pull money out of their reserves and put it back into circulation. So the money that the Feds have been printing has been sopped up on the other side by the banks, who are not putting that money back into circulation because now they get a nice return on their investment for keeping money in reserves. At some point, when the economy gets stronger and it's more appealing to a bank to loan that money out to get a better rate of return, a safer rate of return, all of a sudden that money's going to start returning to the market.
But that's not the case right now.
Not right now. But it's sitting out there. And when that does happen, that could, in fact, create inflation. And that could, in fact, be one of the catalysts that starts to drive rates up. And when that happens, that's not a short-term cycle. So that's really an incentive. If you're thinking about buying a house, I would tell you really need to take a look at buying something while rates are this low, because it makes a really big difference.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, people think, a lot of people think, Randy, if you got a bad economy, there's a great solution. Print more money, you know. I always thought that as a kid. Wanted to print, you know,
it is.
More
and
money.
And it's the Fed is doing that a short term to keep things from getting worse. But there is, you know, everything, there's an action and reaction to everything. So that's kind of an idea of where rates come from as far as the mortgage bonds. They're determined by retail reports, inflation reports, labor reports that come out. The labor reports that come out the first week of the month, some of the most impactful reports that come out. And I would tell you, it's something that's important that we do for our clients is we say, look, here's a report that's coming out on Friday. If you bought your house and you're looking at rates, do you want to lock in Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday before that report hits? or do you want to wait till the report hits and then try to make a decision after it hits about whether you want to lock in, keeping in mind that they could go up or down, but at least you're armed with that information to make a decision.
Can they do both? Can they lock in now, and then if they find that the announcement on Friday is more favorable than what they locked in at,
it's kind of like you want to buy Apple
stock, have your cake and eat it too.
And then all of a sudden the report comes out, Apple drops $50, and you go, no, I'd rather buy at that price. Well, you already bought. You can't unbuy a stock. Now, with a loan, it's like that, but there's a little difference. Lenders recognize that if rates drop enough, that there are some consequences in the market. So typically, if rates do drop a certain amount, every lender has a different policy, and it's not a bad idea when you're shopping around to ask, what happens if rates go down? Do you have what they call a float-down policy? Most lenders do. So there is a float-down policy. If rates drop 3/8 or half a point or more, you can typically get a little bit better rate, and it has to happen usually within 10 days of closing.
Randy, did you ever see this thing, maybe a gas station puts on a promotion where they're going to sell gas for today only $2.99 a gallon, substantially less than, and they will have a line of cars a block long, maybe longer, to save how much? 15, 20 cents a gallon?
Yeah.
It's just, when you think about it, it doesn't really make sense.
They're trying to save $2, they're going to drive and spend $2 worth of gas to save
right, from
$2
Stone Mountain to Kennesaw,
So, now let's talk about something else that people probably do not know about the mortgage industry that's changed a little bit. When I started in the industry in 1989, we would give people disclosures, and I think there were maybe 11 or 12 pages of disclosures for a loan. Today, on a conventional loan, there are probably 35 pages of disclosures.
Wow.
And on a FHA loan, there may be up to 50 pages of disclosures.
Wow.
It's just an inordinate. You have the Equal Credit Opportunity
Who's going to read that?
Nobody reads it. I won't say nobody reads it, but
hey, Randy, do you ever once in a while, do you get somebody who wants to read it page
sure.
by page, line by line?
We do. And, I will tell you probably about once every year or two, I'll sit down and reread all the disclosures just to stay familiar with them. Because people will call and ask you, what's this disclosure for? And you need to be able to kind of give them an explanation. There are some things on the Truth in Lending disclosure that create a lot of questions. APR being the first one. The second one says that if you paid any interest back into the loan and you pay the loan off early, you can't get interest back. And so people go, oh, wait a minute, is that a prepayment penalty? No, there's very few loans out there with prepayment penalties, but it does say that once you make a mortgage payment and you've paid that interest in, you're not entitled to any of that interest back should you pay the loan off early.
By the way, they used to have prepayment penalties.
It used
Remember,
to be
years ago,
common.
3% in the first year,
It would be 3% year one, 2% year
two,
1% on the third year, and then the fourth year, none. But, the government's kind of stepped in with some of the regulation, and one of the things for a qualified mortgage, which took place January 10th of this year, is that you can't have on a traditional loan a prepayment penalty. You can't sell that loan to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac if there's a prepayment penalty, if there's a balloon note, if there's negative amortization. So they've kind of moved all that stuff off to the side.
I'll bet people love that you know all this.
Yeah, you know what?
I'll bet 90% of the people in your business don't know the things that you've just talked about.
Here's the thing, and this is a big, big thing for us, is we tell people what's going on. But for me, I've always wanted to know, that's great, but why do I have to do that? If I'm flying on an airplane, why do I have to take off my shoes? Why do I have to take off my belt when I go fly on a plane? And when you're doing a mortgage, people look at you and go, well, why do you have to look at my income this way? Why can't I do it? And I'll give you an example. There's an underwriting guideline that a lot of people just don't understand, which is, I've got a house, and I want to go buy another house. And it's 3 miles down the road, but it's in a different school district. It's the same size of house. Everything looks good. In fact, it may even be the same price of a house. So why does the underwriter care? And the answer is because a lot of people try to commit fraud by doing that. And there was a situation out in Las Vegas that I was made aware of where a couple had a house they bought for about $300,000. Prices really crashed out there when they went down. And it went down almost 50% to $150,000. They had foreclosures all around them, vacancies all around them. Their house had just dropped. Now, here's a couple that put 3.5% down, and now all of a sudden, 3 years later, they find themselves $150,000 upside down.
Wow.
So what's the solution? Well, that dream home that we really liked a couple years ago? It was $500,000, but it's only $275,000 now. So let's rent our current house out and then go buy that $275,000 house, which was our $500,000 home just a few years ago. So what happened was this couple basically kind of got a rental contract on their property, and they said, okay, our payment on this property is $1,200, but we've got rent for $1,500. Wipes that payment out. Now we can go qualify for a $275,000 home.
So how is that fraud? Doesn't sound fraudulent to me.
It's not so far. Until they move in the $275,000 house, the person that signed the lease was their good buddy, wink, wink, nod, nod at work, and they didn't make the payment on the rental house. It went back into foreclosure, and all of a sudden they got their dream home. They got rid of a $150,000 problem, offloaded that to the bank, and basically took care of their $150,000 debt.
So he never intended, that buddy at work intended to...
No, but there was no regulation in place for it. Now, they have an underwriting guideline that prohibits that. I'll tell you about that when we come back from break. So this is Randy McMullen with Keeping It Real. You can find us at www.amstarloans.com.
And now, back to Keeping It Real with Randy McMullen of Amstar Mortgage Network. Visit AmstarLoans.com.
We are back, and we're talking about what people don't know about the mortgage industry. We were talking about a situation where a couple had bought a home. They rented their current home and bought a new home. And the underwriting guideline that they put into place said, you know, if you're upside down in a home, you can't put a rental contract on it and then go buy another home because the likelihood of you stopping to make payments is too great. Not that you would, but enough people did it that it created a problem, so they had to stop that from happening. So they said, okay, here's a new guideline. In order to count that rent against your other payment, you have to have 30% equity in your property. If you've got 30% equity, and you move to a new home, you're not going to walk away from that 30%.
This guy had zero
equity.
He was upside down.
Negative equity. So he had no incentive to make the payment. In fact, probably never intended to make it. This was happening all over the place in Florida, California, Phoenix, Arizona, Las Vegas, Nevada, all these places that suffered these huge drops. People had figured out a way, legal as it may be, although maybe the rental contract wasn't quite as ethical as you might have liked to see it, but that's what happened, so the government put a stop to it. So there are so many complex guidelines and so much detail. When I look at Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, and VA, and people wonder why is this so complex, it's 3,500 pages of guidelines. And, you know, our job is to know which guideline is best suited for you. I'll give you another example. I've got a client who's buying a house. They're buying it for their son. Typically, she could buy it as an investment property and put 20 to 25% down. But if you want to do what they call a non-occupant co-borrower, in other words, the parent co-signs for the son. Now, the parent is a non-occupant co-borrower. They're on the loan. They're obligated. The son's on the loan, and maybe the son wouldn't qualify for the house by himself, but with the parents' financial strength, they can do that. Fannie Mae, they won't do that loan. They have a guideline that says you can't use the income from the co-borrower, the non-occupant co-borrower. Freddie Mac says, no, that's okay. You can use the income from the co-borrower. In fact, the borrower, who's going to be the occupant, doesn't have to have any income. So here's a way where we can get a loan for a client with a smaller down payment and a lower interest rate if you just know how to package that loan.
Why is the son's name even on the thing?
Well, they want to build his credit, and at some point the son's on title. The son may want to keep that property at some point in time. And a lot of people just want, I'm working a loan right now, and I've got a client. I think the son is probably 19 or 20 years old with a 770 credit score.
Wow.
And his mom has been working on building his credit since he was 16. It's a really smart thing to do. And so now his mom is getting him on a mortgage and going to help him make the payments and establish his credit. When he gets out of college, he's going to have his credit, his degree. It's going to be really well set up.
Randy, I wonder, though, this being tax season right now, would the parents be able to deduct the interest that they pay on that mortgage against their taxes?
It's really kind of a CPA question. It's my understanding you can deduct a mortgage on a first and a second home. So this would be almost tantamount to a second mortgage, but I would certainly recommend you contact your CPA on that and get some good financial advice, particularly this time of year if you're planning on doing something like that.
Way to cover yourself.
Yeah.
That's great.
There's a lot of other things that come into play. You know, have you ever been late on your mortgage? Have you had a short sale, foreclosure, even a loan modification? All impact your credit, and there are different guidelines for each particular situation. So you can't say, okay, you got to wait 2 years. It might be 2 years. It might be 4 years. It might be 7 years. You might have to put 5%, 10%, or 20% down. Each one is a little different, and you just need to know how to handle that.
How do you keep up with all this? Are we going to get to that at all?
We'll get to that. I'm going to tell you about that here in just a couple of minutes. The other thing I want to talk about, and this is really important, is, and this is where you really need to have the mortgage person in your corner, is credit scores. Now, it's not that there's a whole you just can't take somebody's credit score and go, okay, 640, poof, you're 740. But you can make some short-term adjustments to somebody's credit score. And there are examples where literally, without exaggeration, 1 point on your credit report score could end up costing you $2,000 or $3,000. And I'll give you an example. If you're buying a house, interest rates, if you've got a 740 or above, you're in that top category. But what a lot of people don't know is if you go below 740, you don't get the same rate. There's an add-on. And if you go below 720, there's another add-on. And if you go below 700, there's another add-on. In fact, every 20 points, it costs more for that same loan. And so if one person has a 680 and another person has a 679 and they're putting 10% down on a house, that one difference, if it's a $250,000 loan and that 1 point, $2,500 difference.
Can those credit scores be trusted?
Yeah. And they're set. You have to deal with them.
Sometimes there's dings in them that should be off the record.
There are. There's a lot of different things that you can do to correct a credit score if there's mistakes on it. But there are other things that we can do where, you know, it's not uncommon for us to say, okay, here's the situation. We ran a model and it said, here's your credit card balance. You owe $800 on this Visa. If you'll pay that down to $400, it'll improve your score by 4 points. And that may be all we need. We'll pay it off. We'll have to repo your credit score because we have to get a new credit score, and then we can use that to process
your loan. The example you just gave, the difference is only 1 point.
1 point.
$2,500.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that affects a lot of people because a lot of people may have a 675, 695, 715, 735, anywhere in there where 5 or 6 extra points could save you literally thousands of dollars.
Can you tell me a few weeks ago, you got a mortgage for a guy with a 620 credit score?
Yes. We actually have some programs on FHA. Most lenders, and when I look at a lot of the big local lenders, they cut off at 640. We have a couple lenders that will do an FHA loan down to 580. And that's a pretty big thing. FHA has a guideline that says 580 is fine. But most lenders don't want to do it because if they do, they're afraid that their foreclosures will be too high. FHA will come back to them and say, hey, your foreclosures are too high. We're cutting you out of the program. So they've done an overlay to say 640. But there are lenders out there that will do 620, 600, 580. Now, there might be a slight difference in rate, and you're going to have to write an explanation about why your credit is down below 640. But it's just an explanation letter to say, hey, I went through a divorce or lost my job. There are a lot of things that happen in real life that impact your credit score that a lender's willing to look at and go, okay, you know what? We look at your credit record for 7 years, perfect, 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 and here's for a year where you had a problem, and now a year later you've reestablished everything. They'll look at that. They're going to make an exception for you if everything else makes sense on your loan. So you really want to, again, talk with your loan officer. Make sure you know exactly what your credit score and is there anything that you can do with your score that might help save you some money at closing. I got some interesting questions for you. And I want you to, if you're driving around thinking about this one, I want you to kind of think about this and we're going to come back. If you're looking at your appraised value and you just painted your house, you just put a new roof on your house, you just got a brand new HVAC system. How much is that going to impact the appraisal? We're going to talk about that when we come back. This is Randy McMullen with Keeping It Real.
And now back to Keeping It Real with Randy McMullen of Amstar Mortgage Network. Visit AmstarLoans.com.
We are back. We're talking about appraisals and things that impact value. And if you're thinking about it, let's just say you just painted your house. You spent $5,000 on your brand new paint job. How much does that raise your appraisal? You just put $7,000 into a new roof. How much value does that add to your house? And you just put in a brand new HVAC system and you spent $6,000 on that. So now you've spent $15,000 on your house. And how much is that going to impact your value?
You know, I would think my house is now $15,000 worth $15,000 more.
You would think. But the reality is, on an appraisal, they're going to look at it and say, well, you put a new paint job. Well, let's see. The houses that we're comparing you to, well, they all have paint jobs. There's nothing special about that. You put a new roof. That's good. The houses that we compare you to, they've got roofs that are 3 or 4 years old. No big deal on that. And you put in a new HVA system. Boy, that's really nice. There's no place on the appraisal where you're going to look at, oh, there's HVA system. Let's put some value. There's nothing for that on the appraisal. So those are three things that you can do that do not impact your appraised value. Now, will they impact your marketability? Can you sell your house faster? You absolutely can sell your house faster. And in reality, you know, there is a part of me that looks at it and goes, will somebody pay more for a house that has new HVAC, new roof, and new paint? I think that they probably would, but there's not a place on the appraisal for it. But you're going to get top dollar for that house, and it's probably going to sell faster than your neighbor who doesn't have those three things.
Why is it not in the appraisal? Would it be hard for the appraiser to be able to get all this information? You know, what am I supposed to say? I want to see your receipt for your new HVAC system?
An appraiser, you know, what kind of HVAC system did you put in? Did you put in a good one or a bad one? Who did the paint job?
Yeah, it's very complicated.
Is it a good paint job or a bad paint job? Because the house down the street, they've got a good paint job. What about your roof? Your appraiser is not going to climb up and inspect the quality of your roof. He's going to expect that you have a roof.
I had hail damage. I got a new roof. Have you ever heard that before?
Oh, I've had that happen myself. I did get a new roof. Was a great thing.
Good for
Paid a little deductible, but, you know, I got a new roof. So, you know, these are all things that you need to be asking your mortgage person about. Where do rates come? When are they going to change? Do you know what impacts rates? If your mortgage person doesn't know what's going to impact rates, you might need to be talking to another mortgage person. Do they have the detail? Do they explain why everything is done? Do they explain what your credit scores are? Do they walk through your credit reports with you? Do you understand what you can do to improve your score? You know, a small thing on an investment property, we tell people, everybody says, let's put 20% down. Well, did you know if you put 25% down, you get a better rate as an investor? And it saves you actually about 1.25%. So you pay 5, you get back 1.25, and in terms of a lower cost, that's an instant 25% return on investment. If you're an investor and you're looking at return on investment, why wouldn't that be something that you want to consider? So that's something, you know, you want to talk to your mortgage person about. Make sure that they understand all these things when you're talking with them. Now, people always ask me, well, gosh, what's the difference in doing business with you, Randy, at Amstar, and, you know, doing business with somebody at any of the other companies here locally? And, you know, there's not one thing. You know, I tell people, it's like, you know, people always say, well, we're committed. You know, we're super committed. Go to your local gym in January and see how many committed people are in that gym in January.
Oh,
it's packed.
That day after New Year's resolution.
I'm committed. I'm going to get in shape. Now go back to the gym in April, May.
It's empty.
How many committed people are there? They were committed, and I'll grant you that, but that's not what it takes. You know, since we've just kind of come up on the Olympic season, I like to talk about what the Olympians do. And they're in the gym in January, February, March, April. There's more than a commitment. These people have a passion for what they do. They have they want to be successful. They want to be the best. They want to be at the top of the game. That is what it takes to be successful in this business. You've got to have a passion for it. You know, I would say for the last 11 years, I have been reading at least 6 hours a week, every week. That's kind of a minimum. In other words, I'm reading 300 hours a year, keeping up with what's going on. It's like a full-time job in addition to a full-time job. And if you figure 300 hours a year, 11 years, 3,300 hours of education, and every week, every month, that education continues, that makes a big difference so that we know what's going on, why it's going on. So I think it's that passion, that drive to do all the little things. We pay attention to detail, and our process is very different. Sometimes you can do your loan, you'll submit your documents to the lender, and then you'll hear back from underwriting in 2 to 3 weeks. We have a really different approach to this, and I think it makes a humongous difference. When you send me your documents, we're actually going to look at it. In fact, I'm going to look at your bank statements. My assistant, Brian, is going to look at your bank statements, and we're going to see, are there any deposits there that the underwriter is going to ask us about? We're going to look at your income, and we're going to calculate it the way that an underwriter is going to calculate it. Then my processor is going to get your file. She's going to look at everything again. So by the time we're ready to send your loan to underwriting, we've really pre-underwritten it 2 to 3 times.
So no surprises.
We just don't get a lot of surprises on the back end. We submit it to underwriting, and we're going to give you a list literally when we submit it to say, these are the things the underwriter is probably going to come back and ask us for. You didn't have your earnest money check when we submitted your file because it hadn't cleared the bank yet. They're going to ask us for that. There was an inquiry that you need to get some explanations for on your credit report. They're going to ask us for that. So we're going to let you work on those things while the file is in underwriting. So when it comes out, we've already collected 95, 97% of the documentation. Just wow. Makes a huge difference.
You know, with all these new regulations now, and there's a ton of paperwork, it's an advantage for Amstar Mortgage, I believe, because your knowledgeability now is more important than it's ever been.
Well, you know, it's a
steel
good point.
Sword.
It shouldn't be an advantage because everybody should be out there reading and keeping up. It doesn't matter who you work for, you can read and keep up. Now, you might not have access to some of the things that we have access to. You know, one of the services that we get is I get live, real-time bond quotes, mortgage-backed bond quotes all the time. And sometimes I can see when the market is moving. And if it's moving big and I've got a client that's floating, I can pick up the phone, make a phone call, and say, the market is just changing. Rates are getting ready to go up in the next literally 3 or 4 minutes. Do you want to lock in right
wow.
now ahead
wow.
of the lock?
Wow.
So if we've got some, we have some tools that maybe everybody doesn't have, and we just use those to our advantage. And it's a small thing. Rates may be going up a quarter of a point. But if you've got a $300,000 loan and we can get ahead of that, we just saved you $750.
Hmm.
If you're thinking about locking in and I can see that rates are actually getting better, I might say, hey, let's hold off on locking in for 2 or 3 or 4 hours and let's see if we get a reprice for the better and we can save another $700 or $800 sometimes. And we've saved customers literally thousands of dollars just because we see what's going on in the market and we can time it and get them ahead and get them to lock at that price. The other thing we do is, you know, we're available. You can call me 7 days a week. Once you're working with me, you have my cell phone number. You have my office line number. You can call me at 7 o'clock at night. I get calls at 10 o'clock at night sometimes that I answer. And so you can work with us a little differently than you're going to find with a local bank. And also on Saturday, you know, you're getting ready to write a contract and you want to know you need to get a pre-qual letter to send with your contract. Call us up. You're probably going to get me on my cell phone. I can get to a computer. Get that letter to you.
See, Saturday is a very important day. It really is.
Saturdays and Sundays are huge days.
But it's hard to reach people.
Yeah. Big days. Saturdays and Sundays are two of our big days for writing pre-qual letters. And if you're not available, then you have to wait till Monday. And in today's market, when you're competing for a home and they're getting offers and you don't want to wait 3 days and let three offers get ahead of you, then you just lost your chance of getting the house of your dreams.
Right now, it's a seller's market, too.
It's absolutely a seller's market.
Better get in.
You know, the other thing we do is expertise. You know, we study a lot, we keep up with all this stuff, and then we help make you, not an expert, but at least you can be more informed. The other thing we do is, gosh, I like the fact that I've got 10 lenders that I can shop in 60 minutes. So when you say, let's lock in, I can look across the board. I can see all my lenders. I can look at all their rates. I can see which one's going to have. Sometimes it's not I'm just shopping for rates. Sometimes I've got to find a Freddie Mac lender because we're doing something that's particular. You know, if you're self-employed, sometimes Freddie Mac will tell us to only to count 1 year of income in your calculations as opposed to 2 years. And if your business was growing and you made $80,000 1 year in 2012, but you made $120,000 in 2013, if we go Freddie Mac, we might be able to use $120,000. If we go Fannie Mae, we've got to average the 2 years and use $100,000. Now, if we go Fannie Mae and your loan went from 120 to 80, your income went down, now you don't want to use Freddie Mac because if it says 1, you're stuck with 80. We can go back and go flip that loan over to Fannie Mae, take a 2-year average, and sometimes get $100,000.
Wow.
So just different situations for different clients.
And these are things that you can do for people.
Absolutely.
Amstar.
There's so many variables that you have to consider. How long you're in the house, what's going on with rates, what's your objective, is it short term, is it long term?
If you can shop 10 rates in under an hour, this is something, frankly, my local bank can't really do.
Yeah, your local bank has their set of rates. They're going to quote what they've got available to them. So you could literally go to four banks and get four rates, or you can call me and I can shop 10 banks for you.
So that loan officer you talked to at the local bank, I mean, he's given a directive. This is the rate.
Here's what you got.
Period.
And by the way, try to get their checking account and try to get their savings account and try to, you know, they're selling a full, you know, and that's why I guess for
a whole range of services,
If you've got to sell a whole range of services, it's got to be a lot more complicated. You've got to keep up with a lot of different things.
Wow.
So, you know, our big difference is not just our commitment, but it's our passion to do a great job to get you the best loan. And so, you know, you're a super satisfied customer. When you get to closing, you've seen the numbers. They were the numbers that you saw up front. There were no surprises. The process went as you expected. You were educated. You made good decisions. You get to closing, and everything goes smoothly. And that is what we do best.
Wow. You know, I'm honored to be working with you, Randy.
Well, I appreciate it. So if you'd like to get a hold of me, please go to www.amstarloans.com. You can find us there 24/7. You'll find a little information. I've got some short videos from myself and a couple other originators that work for Amstar, and you can literally get to meet the team over at Amstar. So give us a call at 770-509-7827 or look us up at www.amstarloans.com. This is Randy McMullen with Keeping It Real. We will see you next week.
This has been Keeping It Real with Randy McMullen, brought to you by Amstar Mortgage Network, NMLS number 148016. Come back next week as Randy McMullen interviews the people important to you for getting a mortgage and preparing to buy or sell a home. For more information, visit AmstarLoans.com and tune in each Friday at noon for Keeping It Real with Randy McMullen, only on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.